One of the most common phrases in today's education literature is the achievement gap. The term produces more than 11 million citations on Google. Achievement gap, much like certain popular culture music stars, has become a crossover hit. It has made its way into common parlance and everyday usage. According to the National Governors Association, the achievement gap is a matter of race and class. Across the U.S., a gap in academic achievement persists between minority and disadvantaged students and their white counterparts. But I want to argue that the all-out focus on the achievement gap moves us towards short-term solutions that are unlikely to address the long-term underlying problem. We do not merely have an achievement gap. We have an education debt.
That's from the 2006 presidential address Gloria Ladson-Billings gave to the American Educational Research Association. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. The statistics can be sobering. Recent reading scores in the United States show that black students on average score 27 points lower than white students in fourth grade and 26 points lower in eighth grade. Wisconsin statistics are even worse, with the highest gap in the country. What are some of the underlying causes of that achievement gap? And what are some of the new ways we should think about eliminating it? Joining us to talk about the achievement gap versus education debt is Gloria Ladson-Billings, professor of curriculum and instruction in the University of Wisconsin School of Education and the author of many works about education, including The Dream Keepers, Successful Teachers of African American Children, and Crossing Over to Canaan, The Journey of New Teachers in Diverse Classrooms. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Let's start with what you say is a very widely used, with all these, 11 million citations on Google, phrase, the achievement gap. What is the achievement gap and what do we know about it?
Well, when people refer to it, they're speaking specifically of the disparity in performance on standardized tests between white and black students, white and Latino students, white and recent immigrant students, white and poor students, white middle class and poor students. It's become kind of a flashpoint. So everyone is sort of talking about, oh, we have an achievement gap, because there is a presumption that all of the students should be performing at the same level. I've tried to argue that the use of this term is misleading. And in fact, in the address that I gave at the American Educational Research Association, I made a kind of economic metaphor to suggest that thinking about the achievement gap is like thinking about the national budget, a kind of year-to-year look at what's going on, without thinking about the national debt, which is this huge amount of debt that is undergirding the entire economy. So I've pushed that economic metaphor to get us to think beyond just what do the test scores look like this year. This constant, incessant focus on testing has really taken much of the real rigor and real joy out of learning.
Well, let's talk about the problem of standardized testing in general, because there's always been bias in the creation of tests. And if you create a test, for example, that asks students to identify a zebra, if they've not been taken to a zoo or read to about a zebra, they won't necessarily recognize it. And that shows more what is in their environment than any sort of innate intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, there's always an issue of bias, but I don't want to hone in on that particularly. What I want to suggest to you is that the test is one slice of what an education experience should be about. So let me give you an example. If you go to your doctor, your family doctor, and it's someone that you know and they know your whole profile, and they take one test, your blood pressure, and it seems kind of off, it's not what they're used to seeing in you, it tells them something, but it doesn't tell them everything. It doesn't tell them, oh, put her in the hospital right this minute because she's having a stroke. It might say to them, ask her what's going on in her life right now. Because I have this entire portfolio or battery of information that tells me more about her. We're using the tests as if they are a lens into youngsters' brains. So the tests tell us something, but they don't tell us everything. One of the things that tests might actually be telling us is that we don't actually teach X. Not that kids don't know it, mm-hmm. but we don't really teach that.
Well, let's talk about, before we get into some of the causes, some of that underlying hidden story that of the debt, let's talk about the actual facts about the achievement gap, because I was kind of shocked to read in the article in the Wisconsin Academy, the Wisconsin People and Ideas that talks about your work, that Wisconsin has the worst record in the nation. And I guess, can you say something about the facts to begin with about the achievement gap?
One of the things that we do use to sort of measure achievement disparity is something called the National Assessment of Educational Progress. That's actually a good thing to use because no one state has determined this is the thing I'll use. Right now, under the current legislation, the No Child Left Behind, each state gets to choose its own tests, and each state gets to choose what the passing score is. So one can be failing the assessment in Colorado, but have those same scores in Texas and be passing.
I didn't know that. I thought it was just like a national
No
child left behind.
Each state gets to choose its own assessment. So that's problematic there. But the national assessment is really not a test of every youngster. The national assessment is a sample across the nation of fourth graders, eighth graders, and 12th graders. So the idea then is to get a snapshot across. So not every African-American student is tested, but there is a representative sample. That way you can line up all 50 states plus the District of Columbia and say, here is the way, you know, this is the way that white students are doing in this state. This is the way that black students are doing in this state. In Wisconsin, the disparity is greater than all of the 50 states and the District of Columbia.
And how bad a disparity is it?
It's bad. We looked at, on average, there's a difference between 26 and 28 points. And they use just raw scores to report these out. Wisconsin's is closer to 30, 33.
And what does that translate into if you compared, for example, the reading ability? Is this just reading or is this also
it's
math?
It's reading and mathematics. Okay. Actually, the national assessment tests most of the core subjects. They roll out reading and math at a particular time. Later, you'll get science. You'll get history. In fact, my own dissertation, which was done many, many years ago, was on what used to be called the citizenship test, which they no longer give.
And I guess, you know, obviously I'd like to know why you think that is in Wisconsin. But then just first of all, what does that translate into in terms of the ability of, let's say you look at Wisconsin fourth graders who have this 30-something point disparity, how does that carry over to just basic ability to read a book?
Well, there's some interesting things about Wisconsin. Number one, Wisconsin has some of the highest national assessment and educational progress scores because they have so many white students. So when you look at the state as a whole, it looks pretty good. It is the disaggregation of the data that shows you you have a glaring problem among African-American students. One of the things that we know about young people is if they are not reading well by fourth grade, the likelihood that they will graduate from high school is really compromised. And so one of the other facts that is actually national, and Wisconsin reflects this also, is that in major urban school districts, you have dropout rates of close to 50% among African-American students, and it is probably even higher among African-American males.
And if you took Milwaukee out of the picture here in Wisconsin, would that make a big difference?
I think we'd have a huge difference, but mm-hmm. then you would have a very skewed picture of,
right.
of where African-Americans are in the state. So you do have to sample correctly, and African-Americans are concentrated in the Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha area with pockets, of course, in Madison and Beloit.
But why would you do you think it is that in Wisconsin, for example, the disparity would be greater than in Mississippi, Alabama, you know, a lot of other places?
One theory is that we have an incredible rate of poverty that nobody's talking about in Wisconsin among African-Americans. So that with this higher poverty rate sitting side by side by what looks like a fair amount of prosperity among white students, the disparities just seem to be larger and larger.
Well, let's talk about some of the ways that you then start looking not so much at just recording the achievement gap, but trying to understand what has led to it. If you look back at history, how do you use history to sort of explain where we are, why it's that way?
Right. One of the things that sort of strikes me about us as Americans is that we seem to have historical amnesia. We just remember what happened yesterday,
yeah.
but we don't really look back. If you look at the history of African-American education, you know that it is a very different trajectory than education among white students. So, for example, we know that African-Americans literally had to fight and die to get an education. I am only one generation myself out of a sharecropping family. My dad grew up in the rural South, and he went to school 3 months a year. So if you only go to school 3 months a year and your white counterparts go nine, then of course you start to have this disparity. If your teachers are not certified and your white counterparts are, if your white counterparts have brand new textbooks and you don't, I mean, so we have all of these historical elements. I think a lot of people in the country would be surprised to learn that we did not have universal secondary school for black children in the nation until the late 1960s.
Wow. Well, I know I was teaching Frederick Douglass's narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass about it being a crime to teach slaves to read and write. And, you know, you see in as you read his narrative where he's being beaten for the act. Or, you know, it's just kind of hard to believe that there was a time in history where it was a crime to teach reading and writing.
Yes.
And it hasn't been that long ago.
And yet that's juxtaposed to, in that same period of time, if you could gather some slave bills where slaves are being auctioned and they describe what skills they have. In a number of those slave bills, it says this person is bilingual, English and French, or this person is, you know, an expert carpenter, or this person is an expert seamstress. So we know they came with knowledge and skills. And the system of slavery used that knowledge and skills when it profited them. But when it seemed to work against that power structure, then they didn't want that knowledge or those skills.
And to what extent do you think that if you have a culture that grew up in this country sort of trying to find alternative forms of expression, oral expression with rhetoric or music and so on, trying to find ways around the lack of literacy, do you think that then becomes sort of part of the history where you find these alternative forms like music or like speech that take over in terms of preeminence?
Actually, I wouldn't think of as alternative forms, but as additional forms, because we have a very long history of literacy in the black community. I mean, you just mentioned Frederick Douglass. This is somebody who learned to read under threat of death.
Right.
There are wonderful examples in the slave narratives of slaves sneaking away, gathering together to learn to read. And their primary reason for wanting to read, and remember at this time, a lot of the country wasn't literate, but their primary reason for wanting to read was to be able to read the Bible. So literacy has always been highly prized in the community, but I think people have added on the oral tradition and the artistic expressions.
And if you look at the history of school inequities between, you know, the 1800s and the time of Frederick Douglass and now, what are the statistics or just sort of the historical record? What does it show us about inequities of funding for schools, inequity of the quality of the education and the access to education?
Yes, school funding inequity is more than a century old. We could look at today's funding inequities, and that tells us something about the pattern in which we've been funding our schools. This is one case in which actually Wisconsin comes out looking a little better because our funding formulas tend to be a little bit more equitable. But if you look at the difference between, say, Chicago public schools and New Trier, which is outside of Chicago, or Philadelphia and Lower Merion, which is a suburbs right outside, or New York and Manhasset, on average, we're talking about a $10,000 per pupil per annum difference.
Wow.
So a fundamental question for me is, what makes kids in the suburbs worth $10,000 more than kids in the city?
And is that because it's rooted to property taxes?
Because it is rooted to the property taxes.
And why is it in our history that we ever rooted education, you know, linked it to property? Was it a deliberate way of sort of, I don't know, keeping disparity there?
I can't say that. What I can say is that the decision to allow education to be a function of the state as opposed to a function of the nation put us in this place. Now, every state and every community understood that schools were vital. There's no place that I've been in the world where I haven't seen two things that people build first. After they find some place to live, they build schools and they build churches. Mm-hmm. I was in a very remote village in Ghana, but I saw the school and I saw the church. So this is something that human beings do. I mean, civilization, I think, demands it. But the funding of these places have been inequitable since the beginning. Number one, I think because we didn't believe that the freedmen really needed to know that much. Pretty much what they needed to know were domestic skills. Many of the historically black colleges and universities have behind them names like A&T or A&I, or they're called institutes as opposed to colleges and universities, because the vision for them was that they would train up a manual class. Indeed, Booker T. Washington's work at Hampton and then at Tuskegee was all about, we don't want to be studying classics or, you know, the traditional liberal arts work. We want to be able to get jobs. But often these titles were a ruse for real university educations because they still offered English and mathematics and science and history.
What did Du Bois have to say about that?
Well, Du Bois, of course, on the opposite end of the spectrum, and I'm actually working on a book on Du Bois and education, and one of the things I'm discovering is the two men were not that far apart in what they actually wanted to happen. The way they expressed it was very different. Du Bois felt that African Americans had to have this sort of classical education to make them able to compete for high-level positions, both social and civic, whereas I think Washington was a realist, and it was that whites will never give us money to do that. And he was an incredible fundraiser, having gotten Andrew Carnegie to put a lot of money into these historically black institutions. If you ever go to some of these colleges, you'll notice that one of the things you should ask is, where's the Carnegie building? Because there's always a Carnegie building. Washington understood that Carnegie was not going to give me money to educate people out of slavery, a generation or two out of slavery, to be in positions that he was in. But he would give me money to educate a labor class.
Well, and what difference do you think it made in terms of this country's history of segregation before Brown versus Board of Education, just in terms of inequities that were due to segregated schools?
Well, you have an entire population that is so far behind that the ability to catch up is really close to impossible. One of the reasons why I say it shouldn't surprise people that we have an achievement gap, as I mentioned, if you just started going to school in the late 1960s, well, why would we expect you to be at the same place as people who have had the privilege and the access to schooling for many, 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 many centuries? So it's made a huge difference in the outcome of the nation. And what we're talking about is all the lost human capital because we haven't allowed people to go to school.
And what is it in terms of what they would have had at, say, let's say it was an inferior segregated school with less funding? Would it have been worse teachers, fewer textbooks?
Well, they would have had cast-off textbooks. They would have shorter time because, again, many of these schools are tied to an agrarian culture which said people have to be out for planting and you have to be out for harvest. They would have had teachers who they themselves did not get the opportunity to go to the best schools. Although there's a sort of interesting twist. None of the historically black colleges a century ago offered advanced degrees. So when black teachers wanted to get advanced degrees, because the white southern universities were segregated, These teachers who had gone to these historically black colleges and were teaching in segregated schools got their advanced education at Teachers College in New York, at the University of Pennsylvania, at the University of Wisconsin, where they actually got superior educations. But they had to go back to a South that would not allow them to teach in integrated settings or to teach white children. So we don't know classroom by classroom what the disadvantage was. We know in the aggregate that they had fewer resources and their teachers probably had less prestigious and stellar credentials, but we have a whole cadre of teachers who actually have better credentials.
I guess I was trying to figure out, too, when you talked about the $10,000 difference per year, and you're talking about now, mm-hmm. like let's say an inner city Chicago school versus one in Highland Park or some suburb.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out that $10,000 per student a year difference. How important is that, the funding?
Well, it's important because it probably speaks to things like class size. You know, every time you reduce the size of a class, you have to spend more money. So Highland Park is willing to have a class size of 20 to 21, where Chicago kids are probably in classrooms at 27 and 28. The other thing that I want people to pay attention to when we use these gross numbers like $10,000 per pupil, that per capita spending is a very crude instrument to measure quality of schooling. It's the one we have. But I always give this sort of simplistic example. If I live in Newark, New Jersey, in a very old house that is decrepit, and you live in Manhattan in a brand new high-rise building, and you give us both $1,000, what I'm able to do with $1,000 is very different from what you can do with it. I may have to get a water heater mm-hmm. fix, and you can't see any difference in my facility because I've had to spend my money on some of the most basic things. You, on the other hand, might be able to put in a great new set of new drapes or art.
Right.
And so people automatically can see, wow, what an improvement. So we talk about this per capita income, but we forget about the fact that most of the schools in urban areas are themselves not in good shape. And so whatever money that gets poured into these schools often goes to things that it's very difficult to notice offhand.
More on the achievement gap and the education debt when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. As a group, without the ability to read well, no future exists for black children in America. The real tragedy is that black American students are no longer just competing against white American students. They are competing educationally against the best and the brightest students globally, and black students are failing miserably. This failure exists after 6 years of No Child Left Behind, 53 years of Brown versus Topeka Board of Education, and 142 years of being technically removed from slavery. If black children cannot read today, they cannot become the black doctors, nurses, lawyers, engineers, bankers, accountants, technologists, business people, or educators of tomorrow who will make black communities successful. If black children cannot read today, they are really no better off than their forefathers who were slaves. That's from a column called No Future Exists for Black Children Who Cannot Read by Philip Jackson. I'm Emily Auerbach, and my guest on University of the Air is Gloria Ladson Billings. We're talking about the achievement gap and the education debt. Well, let's talk about Brown versus Board of Education, okay. which Phil Jackson refers to in that column that, you know, we're 53 years or more past the Brown versus Topeka Board of Education decision. What difference did that 1954 decision make?
Well, the cynic in me says not much, and I know that's a heresy to say that in America because Brown is really iconic. I have a colleague, Diana Hess, who studies Supreme Court and the kind of court cases that should be taught in high school. And Professor Hess has actually talked to Supreme Court justices and asked them to give her a list of what cases must be taught. You know, if you can only mm-hmm. teach so many decisions, what must be taught? Everybody includes Brown. I mean, you always have Marbury versus Madison or, you know, something, but Brown is there. It holds such high status in American culture. Why I've become somewhat cynical is that here we are now, 53 years past Brown, and black children are probably more segregated today than they were before Brown.
Well, do you think, before we get to that problem, do you think the reason it has such an iconic place is because it did translate into, you know, National Guard being called out to sort of force, whether it was in Mississippi or Alabama or elsewhere, to kind of overrule what was happening in various states? It did play a role, right?
Yes, but we can never lose sight of history. Brown happened at the same time we were in the midst of a Cold War that we were trying to win. And so while we were touting democracy, the Soviets were showing the rest of the world, the non-aligned world in particular, because they were, you know, this was a fight over who was going to line up with the U.S. versus the Soviet Union. They were showing the non-aligned, look, they don't even let their own citizens go to school. So this Brown decision has a much bigger footprint than just education. This was about proving to the rest of the world that we were indeed democratic. So in some ways, the schooling benefits are ancillary. Brown served a very different purpose. And it is important. I don't want to suggest that it isn't. But there was a cost to the black community for Brown. Over 138,000 black teachers lost their job for Brown.
Now, why was that?
Because you consolidated schools. And while it was true that you were going to allow these black children to attend these schools, you were under no obligation to hire those black teachers they once had. So across the South, there were, you know, they said, we don't need that many teachers. And the people who lost their jobs tended to be black teachers. The black administrators were demoted into classroom settings. I was actually at the University of North Carolina for a celebration of the 40th anniversary and met with a group of adults who were the first class to integrate the Chapel Hill School. So these people were, you know, in their 50s. And the pain was still very deep where they said, you know, we came up here and nothing that we had accomplished or done before came with us. We had been state champions for athletic contests. We had these wonderful teachers who loved us. We had this, we had that. And none of that came. It's like all of that history just vanished. We just now were plopped down in Chapel Hill schools. So we don't think about that Brown actually cost us something. However, most black teachers in the South said it was worth it. They knew they were going to lose their jobs, but it's still worth it.
Yeah. I have a couple of returning adult students in my class right now who first were in segregated Chicago schools with battered textbooks and so on. But then after Brown, they were transferred or bussed. And then they apparently had just sort of the racism that came with it. And also teachers who made them feel as if they must be inferior or they didn't belong.
Well, think about how sick a system we must have that you have to bring the National Guard out to allow children to go to school. That one little girl in New Orleans, Ruby Bridges, has to be accompanied by federal marshals and spends an entire year in school as the only child in school, and only one teacher is willing to teach her. There's something in the American psyche around race that hopefully we are about to get over. But that was all a part of what Brown brought us. There's an interesting piece of work done by a woman named Vanessa Siddle Walker at Emory University. She studied what was called the Caswell County Training School, which was a segregated all-black school. And she raises the question in her work, is there such a thing as a good black segregated school? And her argument is that the presumption post-Brown is that the black school is always the worst school. Her research documents that the Caswell County School was actually the better school, but they made them close that one. And all the kids had to go to the white school, which actually was an inferior school because they were all rural schools. I mean, the rural schools are always going to be in worse shape than urban schools, period. But yet, the notion that it was an all-black school seemed to intimate that it can't be the good school.
Were there some strengths, too, to having all-black schools the way sort of within the gender division? Sometimes within a same-sex classroom, girls speak up more. They're not as afraid to show that they're good in math and science, and there can be a kind of freedom that happens.
Yeah, there is that, but I think Gary Orfield, who has been a champion of school desegregation, would would argue that that doesn't override the real problem of the social and psychological impact of segregation. The one segregated instance that we never talk about is white segregation. We never call those schools segregated. When we say segregated, we presume Black or Latino. But many of the white schools are segregated. And I know people probably won't agree with this, but there is some disadvantage for white students to be in all white schools.
Sure. And isn't it mostly a reflection of segregated neighborhoods?
Exactly. Exactly. And
segregated kind of economic resources sometimes as
well.
And
we have a history in the nation of expecting the schools to do things that the adults don't want to do. So we don't want to live next to each other, but we want the kids to be in school next to each other. We don't want to make sure that people have a living wage, so we want schools to feed the children. We don't want to talk about sex, so schools should do it. So we have this history, and it's played out most dramatically around this issue of segregation.
And during the time of Brown versus Board of Education, during the arguments over that case, were there studies brought to the fore then that still remain important? I mean, I remember seeing just recently somebody had repeated some of the tests on dolls that were used back with Brown, and not much had changed in terms of body image and self-esteem and so on.
Yes. One of the reasons that Brown remains landmark is the first time that social science evidence is brought into the courtroom to show the impact of whatever decision. In this case, we're talking about school segregation. So the argument that the plaintiffs made was the psychological damage that was happening to Black children as a result of being in a segregated system. And you're right, there was a young woman, only 17 or 18 years old, who has done a film called A Girl Like Me, in which she replicates the study. And the majority of these youngsters, who are about 4 or 5 years old, continue to choose the white doll as the preferable doll.
And how is it related to sort of the argument in favor of integration of the schools?
Well, I think the sense of integration is, and this is, you know, Gordon Allport's contact theory, that when people get to know each other, then some of these barriers begin to fall away. But it's a complicated thing, because I certainly have seen instances where people have no problem with school integration from about kindergarten to about grade 4 or 5. But as youngsters move into puberty, as they get interested in romantic relationships with other youngsters, families will retreat from those integrated settings.
In your address that you gave as president of the Educational Research Association, you talk about the problem of African-American communities not being as involved in decision-making, not
right.
having a say.
And this is part of what I would call the socio-political aspect of this debt. The fact that school is a local concern, it's delegated to the states, and then the states delegated to local school districts and communities, means that this is the one place of government that everybody can be involved. You can actually see your elected official on a regular basis, whereas you can't see your senator or your congressperson or the president in the same way. You have access to this person. And yet, because Blacks were disenfranchised, because they could not participate in the political system, they didn't have much say over what kinds of schools. So even these segregated schools were run by a white power structure.
And to what extent does it matter to be able to vote? What difference does it? Are you talking about electing school board officials?
It's about electing school board officials. It's about being able to attend school board meetings. It's about expressing your opinion about the content of the curriculum and the nature of requirements. One of the most energized school debates we've had came in New York in the Brownsville Oceanside strike between not teachers and the system so much as, but teachers and the community. And the community took over those schools and opened them and ran them and realized, you know what, we actually do have some power. We actually can do some things. I think in many ways, Black poor communities experience schools in a colonial setting. In other words, some entity from outside of our community has come and established a school here, and we have to send our kids to it.
Well, and maybe going along with that colonial sort of structure is sometimes, it seems to me, patronizing attitude that comes with it. I'm thinking of the scene in the autobiography of Malcolm X where he talks about wanting to be a lawyer and he's told to be a carpenter.
Yes.
That's more realistic.
Right.
And, you know, the stories you hear of guidance counselors steering students of color into non-college-bound classes, just assuming they shouldn't be in an honors
right.
class or whatever.
Right.
How much do you think racist assumptions play into what classes students take, what they even expect of themselves?
Well, I think that that happens all too often. In fact, I just read an article by the late John Ogbu, and people will know John Ogbu's work because he was involved in the piece almost 20 years ago on the burden of acting white, the sense that there was a black peer culture that kept black students from doing well in schools. It's a complex environment. You have kids, I mean, and we forget they are kids, and so they can only make kid decisions. They can't make adult decisions. You know, when you're 13, you can't decide rationally what's the right thing to take. You need an adult, a knowledgeable adult, to say, you know, you really ought to take algebra, or you really ought to take Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Courses that, you know, if I'm 13 and I really don't want to work very hard, which is pretty typical, I wouldn't take on my own. So the environment that kids find themselves in are environments where people are not encouraging them. They're also not seeing any people in the positions that they may aspire to. The typical kid believes that teachers have to be white in many of our school districts because that's who the teachers are. I had a youngster here in Madison, an African-American kid, interview me for a project he was doing. And I think three times in the interview, he stopped and said to me, "You teach here?" And finally, I said to him, "Why do you keep asking me that question?" He said, "I didn't know black people could teach above high school."
Oh, that's pretty sad.
It is sad.
But very revealing as
yes.
well. I had a student from South Carolina who signed away his education benefits when an Army recruiter came along because the recruiter in South Carolina said, "People like you don't go to college."
Exactly.
You know, this idea that you're not college material, that this is not something that's part of your future.
Right.
You do start wondering to what extent expectations matter.
Yes.
From an early
and actually,
age.
We have a pretty good psychological literature that says teacher expectations play an important role in student achievement.
I think I read somewhere, too, that you had sort of a experience along those lines with your own daughter in a Wisconsin school.
Yes. Who is brilliant. And this is not just the mother in me saying, because there's other things I might say about her that are not as flattering. But she is brilliant. She is really, she has an incredibly analytic mind. Technically, she knows how to do all the stuff that mom, who was a Luddite, doesn't know how to do. And she loves mathematics and science. And so she pushed herself to be able to take very challenging mathematics courses. And she was discouraged at every turn. Now, she's a college student, and you look at her transcript, and she's got tons of math courses on there, which she's done excellent in. But there was no support for what she wanted to do in high school. And at one point, she was just really ready to give up.
And I think you said that in an honors class, some teacher asked if she was in the right room.
Every day. I mean, not just one time.
Just once.
Every day he'd say to her, "Are you sure you're in the right classroom?"
More on the achievement gap and the education debt and various reasons for it when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere." That's a quote from Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with our guest, Gloria Ladson-Billings. We're talking about the achievement gap in education and some of the underlying causes of that. We've been talking about some of the historical reasons why there is a gap in the test scores between black and white students, some of the history of Brown versus Board of Education and the continuing problem. So let me ask you the question, why does it matter as a country that we fix this problem and fix it quickly?
Well, I think that your question goes straight to something that I'm deeply passionate about, and that is that I believe we have a moral debt. Again, I have to look back at history. If you look at a point in the Civil War, right before African Americans were allowed to participate in the Union Army, because Lincoln really did resist that for a while, the Union was losing. And right after Lincoln okayed the conscription of African Americans into the Union Army, something like 200,000 African Americans joined. It turned the war. So in many ways, this is a people who saved the entire nation. And if you go back and look through all of our participation, we have participated in every single war in large numbers. We are deeply committed to this dream called democracy. So you have to ask yourself, what do we owe a people who literally put their lives on the line to save the nation? There's a morality there that I think has to be addressed. And we have to address it because we can't really achieve this democratic project that we're all involved in without addressing it. You can't bring a portion of a nation along. We are seeing right now a kind of explosion in democratic projects around the world where people are looking to democracy. And we have an obligation. It's a project that we've been involved in for over 200 years. We're not there yet. And this is probably one of the least of the things that should be keeping us back. Think about, again, the amount of human capital we are squandering. We are a nation that has over 1 million people incarcerated. You cannot be productive and democratic with those levels of human capital sequestered away behind bars. We have to address it because it's really what I think America's all about. We understood way back with Jefferson that education was the only way you can sustain a democracy. So it's going to be very difficult to reach our democratic ideals without an educated citizenry. In the end of the address, one of the things that I pointed my audience to, and of course you can't tell it on paper because there was a movie attached to the address, but I took people back to Hurricane Katrina. And those images that I was able to secure from the Times-Picayune that just showed people being left out not only are poignant, but they underscore the huge disparities. To separate out this achievement gap without talking about the fact that we have a health gap, that we have housing gaps, that we have employment gaps, is to me disingenuous. To assume that, well, we'll fix our gap by just getting everybody in school is not really realistic or sincere in my estimation.
It was interesting with Hurricane Katrina to see politicians acting, or just the general public, acting surprised
yes.
to see poverty.
Yes.
Which I guess underscores your point that we sort of don't face a lot of the true problems in the country.
Exactly. I had the unique experience of being out of the country when Katrina hit. I was in London. And to watch it on CNN World or the BBC was like watching something happening in some nation that was much less technologically advanced. It was surreal. And people would ask me, you know, day by day, what's happening in your country? What in the world's going on? And for a couple of days, I didn't have an answer. But around about the third day, when someone asked me that question, I said, well, the difference between those people today and 2 weeks ago is now they're wet.
Mm-hmm.
2 weeks ago, they had substandard housing. 2 weeks ago, they had substandard health care. 2 weeks ago, they had substandard schooling. 2 weeks ago, they had substandard employment. Now they're wet. And I often talk about the, quote, gift of Katrina, and I have gift in quotes, is that it washed all these things to the surface. The question is whether or not we have decided to once again turn away. I think on today's newscast, I heard that those people living in trailers are getting very, very ill because of the formaldehyde outgassing. So we've kind of put them somewhere, but we haven't really done very much for them.
And what would you say to people who would say, but we've had affirmative action for a quarter of a century or more. Wasn't that supposed to do what you're talking about, to sort of rectify the mistakes of the past.
Well, actually, affirmative action did do what it was supposed to do to a large extent. The entire black middle class that we now see, and that is a number that's growing, are beneficiaries of affirmative action. I am a beneficiary of affirmative action. I had an experience once in one of my classes, and most of my students here at the university are white, where we were debating affirmative action. And I let the students kind of go back and forth for a while over it. And they couldn't reach any resolution. Some thought it was unfair. So finally I said, okay, let's do this. Anybody in this room who has benefited from affirmative action, please leave. Well, they kind of looked around at each other. And then I packed up my things and left them. And then about 5 minutes later, there was a knock on my door and they said, we get it. In other words, you benefit because I benefited.
How did you benefit?
Well, because I was able to go to college. I was able to go for advanced degrees. It's not like you get it and then you hold it. The other thing we forget is that the major beneficiaries of affirmative action are white women. And that's just because of the numbers. And it's not as if white women all live on some island called white women, where only they benefit. They take those jobs, the income from those jobs, into their own homes, where white men, presumably, and white children also benefit. So it's not a zero-sum game. The other thing I think people forget is that one of the people who actually coined this phrase, affirmative action, is Richard Nixon, and that he was very much in favor of it, even though he wasn't in favor of school desegregation. But the point of affirmative action is not to benefit individuals. It's to raise the question, how can we benefit the society? How can we better position the society?
Does it come at a cost, too, though, affirmative action, in the sense that, let's say you are an African-American doctor, do you have patients looking at you and thinking you got in with lower admission standards? Do you have resentment that builds up? Does it come at a cost?
Well, 40% of the undergraduates at Harvard University are legacy students. 40%.
Children of alumni.
They are children of alumni. Now, do we say that? Well, maybe
that's
we do.
That's kind of affirming some sort of action.
Right.
It's just we don't think of it that way.
I can't believe that our president got to Yale on his grades. I mean, he himself says, I was kind of a C student. So here are these ways in which we've always benefited certain groups of people. We give GIs the GI Bill, not because they're good GIs, but because they were GIs, not because they got the, Purple Heart or Silver Cross. It's because they were GIs. We give alumni children a bump in many of our universities, not because they're good alumni, but because they're alumni or because their kids are good. So even though we talk a language of individual achievement in a nation of over, what are we now at, 300 million? I mean, we're a huge nation. We're always in groups of some kind. We can't even manage the nation without thinking of what group are you in. So the idea that you have historically, economically, and sociopolitically disadvantaged a group, that maybe you ought to give them some advantage. There's a wonderful historian, I believe he's now at Princeton, Walter Johnson, who studies the history of slavery. And Walter argues that one of the mistakes we've made is to try to make the slaves' narrative match with the American narrative. So we say, for example, as a nation, we were fighting for freedom. And then we turn around and say, and these slaves, they were fighting for freedom. We never say that. Yeah, but they were fighting for freedom against the nation. So Walter said, the slaves were indeed prisoners of war. And we have never not made reparation to prisoners of war, except in the case of Africans and African Americans.
That's an interesting way to look at it.
So the idea that you would help them in this way. And so one of the, I proposed some fairly radical things that says, by virtue of being born black in America, there's certain things you ought to get. And it hasn't had anything to do with whether your parents were good parents. But there's been an incredible price paid by African Americans so that you ought to get some benefit from that, just as GIs get some benefit.
Well, in the final minutes, let's just turn to some of the work you've done in curriculum changes. I know your book Dream Keepers, for example, looks at successful teachers. The crossing over to Canaan looks at diverse classrooms. Mm-hmm. What sort of recommendations do you tend to make if you're speaking to school boards or to teachers about what ought to go into the curriculum?
Well, I think when we look at the statistics, we can become overwhelmed and presume that there is nothing that we can do. And I don't want to leave people without hope. The work in the Dream Keepers really function as what you might call an existence proof, because so much of the literature is doom and gloom. Nothing can be done with these poor black children. The problem is their parents. The problem is their community. They can't do this. They can't do that. And I really set out to do a study that said, actually, there are people who are proving you wrong on this point. So I found a group of teachers just by kind of canvassing community, saying, you know, if there's any teacher you would pick for your child, who would it be? And spent 3 years studying these 8 teachers who were just magnificent. And as I said, they serve as kind of existent proofs to show that if you actually believe kids are capable of learning and you believe that you have the responsibility to teach them, some wonderful things can happen. And it's not about having a particular system of teaching or style of teaching or even a specific curriculum. But it is about the kind of synergy that happens when you actually believe people can learn and you believe that you're capable of teaching them. So that's kind of the work that I've been doing and really trying to move school districts in particular away from what has become the resurgence of this culture of poverty discourse. I find that very dangerous and wrongheaded.
Gloria Latson-Billings, thanks for joining me for University of the Air. It's been
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.
Next Sunday afternoon at 4 during University of the Air, what was it like living in Nazi-occupied Denmark? We'll find out when our guest, Niels Ingwersen, speaks of 5 years of damnation. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.